Today is the 27th of October, a month of the birthday of Oliver Reginald Tambo. Amongst other things, it's the birthday of the whip of the comics. We are here to hear presentations from two entities of the department. When we were interacting with the department and the entities during the last 2 weeks, we took a decision that there's areas that we need to interrogate further. When it came to the EAB, we wanted to hear more about the management of the digital business program together with the department and the One Learner program, particularly because those were one of the preference areas of the minister. That the minister has promised that they will be done. When we interacted with NHBRC, they presented to us the transformation program, which was in primary form. And we hope that you agreed that we would like to hear more about this program and understand it further. Particularly because from where we are sitting, NHBRC still needs to do more in terms of transforming itself. So those are the two presentations that we're going to get. And also, initially, we were supposed to get a head presentation from the FSC, Financial Fiscal Commission, because when they interacted with us, they had expressed a need for interaction further on the issue of the accreditation of the municipalities, because they felt that they were the ones that actually initiated, they were part of the initiation of the process, but there are things that they seem to find in media, and they are not interacting fully with the department on this issue. We then invited them. But you will notice that in the agenda and the program today, they are not there. We've taken them off the program, because with my interaction with the chairperson of the FSC, it emerged that they are having a meeting with the department this week on Thursday. So we felt that it is going to be important that we allow them to meet the department first, so that when they come to us, they would have then met the department. And when we interact with them, because us will be interacting with them at a policy level, at a political level, at the understanding level, the department will be explaining things further, practically. So that's why then they are not here today. We hope then to include them in the program of next week after they have met the department. So I just wanted to make that clarity. But we are all welcome in the meeting. We hope to have fruitful interactions. We also have an apology from a member who seems to think that because of the weather in Amtata, the flight can't leave or can, whatever that means. So she is unable to leave Amtata to come to Kenya. So she's not part of the meeting. Everybody else that is not here, I'm hoping that they are not taken by the wave of the Sigma's fall and forgot that in that process you still have work to do within the Sigma's fall process. So we're here because I don't have any other apologies. That's the meeting, and you are all welcome. And thank you very much for gracing us with your presence. Now, when I'm looking at the screen, it looks like EAB is ready to start with the presentation. I just want to say in advance the air use preservation must be augmented by the department in terms of saying more, because remember, particularly the diabetic people, because when we interacted with the department itself on that issue, so as far as I know, this program is a program that is co-held by the department and if you only want to know one of the agencies program, I would want to hear the views of the department once the EAP has given that, so that we live here understanding that whatever we got presented by the entity, the department is accurate or understand. So yes, so that way we are. So I'm going to allow the AAP to start. They are going to present them, to present themselves to the committee to say who they are. I know them by now, but I'm not going to present them to you. They will present themselves. I think there are two of them are here. Four. I didn't see the fourth one. Oh, okay. Chairperson of the board of the AAP. I was quite impressed that you are here in the midst of the revolution in the school and the university. And I thought you would be held up at the University of Finance dealing with the issues. But I can't record the chairperson of the board. You can introduce the rest of the team.
Thank you very much, chairperson. My name is Gwandi Wagonjo. I am the chairperson of the Estate Agency Affairs Board. And the chairperson is correct to indicate that I work for the University of Johannesburg and the fee is my fault, but it is still the fever of the day. But it was very important that I should come here to support the administrative team of the Estate Agency Affairs Board. I have with me the CEO of the Estate Agency Affairs Board, Brian Chabok, and two members of his executive team, Neville Arantza and Anton Arantza, sorry. Anton Arantza.
Do you want to believe that Neville and Anton is the same thing?
No, it's not the same thing, definitely. And Nikita Sigaba. Brian will get through the presentation on the One Learner, One Essay Agency Youth Empowerment Brigade program. And I really hope that the interaction after the presentation will be fruitful and useful to us as the Estate Agency Affairs Board. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Konza. Mr. Chetlock, we hand over to you to present to us.
Thank you very much, Chair, and honorable members, for the time that you've been afforded, also for the department that is present here to support us. Chair, the program, after the last time presented, there was a request on the committee to give more detail and to talk through a bit more in, I would think, a bit of a workshop to a format where we would actually even look at some of the what has been achieved, but also how we can enhance the program as it is, the program has got a longer life, and it's our intention that we can get good inputs from the portfolio committee as well as we present. So the One Learner State Agency Youth Empowerment Brigade program is really focused at achieving the transformation in this very untransformed sector. We are very aware that 60% of all buyers are black when it comes to property, and that they are being serviced by a very untransformed sector, even 20 years after our new dispensation. So the program is really there where a young disadvantage as a young intern will be placed in the service of a currently registered estate agency. It's a very important component that they have to be in good standing, that they must be registered and they have a business that's operating, and they can take on a learner or more and put them under their supervision or control and will mentor them for a 12-month period. Now when they start, they actually do start with an employment letter So the 12 months is really a component of an employment relationship that has started. It's not the beginning and end of the 12 months. You start with employment letter, then you go on to what we call an internship program so that you can be trained on what this effect is about. And during that term, you will now become more aware of what is happening in the property market, because you will be actually going through the on-the-job training and also your ethical training so that you can get the required real estate qualifications. So the program is structured in such a fashion that you are obviously employed. Then you go through the on-the-job practical training and also your theoretical training. We're targeting young people specifically because the average age of this sector is about 55 years old. It's 95% white, and there is a youth transformation element that's urgent, and also a better reflection of the demographics of South Africa. So we're looking at 10,000 Indian agents will be sourced over a 3-year period to take part in this program. We are specifically focusing on matriculants, on those from the TV colleges, universities, university of technology graduates, persons with disabilities. And it is a focus area that already covers the element of youth for us, and then we're also looking at that to provide an optional class of 24 and class of 23 matriculants that are finding themselves battling with job that they can absorb into this training program. So once you've completed the 12-month internship, then you'll be certified against the NQF4 real estate qualification, because during the 12-month period they will go through practical, then they will enroll and they will pass an exam that they write with the regulator, the EAB. It's called the professional designated exam, and that examination will give them professional qualification to put behind their name, called PPRE, or the professional practitioner in real estate. What is good about that is that you have a professional qualification that is registered with SACWA, and you are in a profession that you can show this is what my qualifications are. So it's a very good, easy route, but very lucrative route for young people to get involved in. After the first qualification where you receive your PE4, you then, in your next cycle of 12 months, complete NKF5 qualifications. And that will also allow you then to write the new exam, where in the second year you can write the Master Practitioner Real Estate exam, which will give you also professional designation behind your name. Now, we've looked at the duration of the program and how many interns have we brought into the program over the time. The program has got two components. It is where we work with real estate companies to get young people on, and then we also work with funding institutions, and so far we've got a funding agreement with the services sector where they are able to provide stipends to the young persons. So in terms of the program where the real estate companies are taking young people in, those young people also complete the 12-month program, they also complete the training, and they are commission earners. So the important thing about this revenue stream that you make in real estate, it's very much commission driven, and it is a quantum of how many properties do you sell with your mentor, and you only share the commission, and therefore they make quite a lot of money in the process. So we've been counting the numbers of how many young people have come into the program, and for 2013 that was 1,945, in 2014 2,700, and up to May, we've had 1,485. And why we counted up to that is because we want to add to that what we've had from the funded program from the CETA. So in terms of the process, how the funded program works, CETA did support us with a funding agreement to fund 906 learners, and they're giving them a stipend from 800 rand if you're a matriculant. They also pay for your training, whatever terms of that training you will have, and they pay some other expenditures. So this target was to then reach a matriculant of 706 matriculants, which we've been able to meet that target. In terms of the intern, and the word they use there, an intern is someone who's got a post-matriculant qualification, So he's got a qualification right from a university or from a TVA college, and an allocation for about 200 of those learners to be targeted. This type of a total of 50,000 to 1,000 rand a month, and there's also a qualification being paid for them and certain other expenditures. So this is also an option for a graduate who's unemployed, who can also enter this real estate with some stipend and do support of money and commission at the same time, just like entrepreneurs. The matriculant allocation, we've been able to meet the qualification, that total. We had an allocation of 306 matriculants that received stipends, and we were able to do that. In terms of the graduates, a lot of the graduates did not find the stipend attractive, so they chose to, someone didn't accept the offer that was there. I think we're now 1,000 rand a month. It is too low a stipend to attract them, so someone to try to another work and just continue applying for certain jobs, only be caught up in another route they're not sure of the income. We have been able to place all of the young people, 100% PDI, and then we focus a lot on black women, which we did receive a good response, and we've been able to place 50% of black women in terms of this. So in terms of that gap, we have not made all the interns, those with graduate qualification, there is no space to place those individuals. Some people feel comfortable in the allocation or in the next allocation that we're working with the funded program from services. This is giving us a bit of a spread of how the learners are looking. And yeah, I think the challenge that was raised previously, and we talk about that today, is how the response from Gauteng, KZN, was, and how the response from the other provinces were. And here we see that that most of the real estate firms are concentrated in Gauteng, and there was a big uptake there. And in KZN, it also got a big number, but some of the other provinces doesn't have such a lot. Western Cape is the one we believe it should have been a better outing, and therefore we are putting additional capacity in Western Cape so that we can try and get the numbers up in terms of that. A very important contributor to this is the host employers. Host employers have to indicate that they want to get interns, and the interns meet within the interviews being held, and then the successful matching happening between the two parties. So it's important for us to work on more host employers. To get more host employers, that means existing real estate firms to actually participate in the program, and that number can be added. The more that number widens up, the more we're going to have placements of young people with these firms. If you look at the current status of the funded program, so where the, we have just talked to the firms in the specific funded program, the documentation was completed in this year, and then on the 18th of June the program started. So far there have been all of those learners completed all of their documents. We do have challenges where if the documents are not complete, then the learner cannot start on the program, but most of that has been sorted out. The learners are getting their stipends, and those stipends are enabling them to have ability to get to work, to go out to their site visits, and also for them to have telecommunication and so forth. So although this type is low, at least it's assisting them. What we are getting as good stories is that some of the young people have already been sold some houses and already starting to be in line for the commission, because sometimes it takes 2-3 months for the commission to come, but they have decided to go in. The commission is going to be very much lucrative for them to be able to get. Some of the challenges that we did see with the stipends is if a learner did not receive his stipend, it could be because the documentation that has come from the host employer, including attendance registers, because the funder, service feeder, wants detailed attendance registers to ensure every person was at work every single day, or with exchange banking details. Those are kind of challenges that we've had, but those kind of things are part of the learning curve if one is implementing a project of this kind of size with a external funder. So we communicated what a cut-off date is to the host employers, so they can be very much strong when they know, and be very clear with the detail and the deadline. If they are not, then we will find that their learners will not receive their stipends on time, when that should be unfair. What they have had, and this is an important aspect, a lot of the host employers are SME firms. And the reason for that, when the service seeker agreed with the funding for this program on their side. They wanted the majority, 55% of the host employers must be SAE firms. The purpose for that was they wanted to say we're giving you a free employee per se, and they wanted them to benefit, where they felt that the big firms have the ability to absorb young people in the only course that they do have the infrastructure. But what the host employers in the SME bracket are experiencing is that the support they are getting financially in the beginning of this program is quite low, 1,000 rand per learner, per intern, per annum, and if they have 5 or 10 learners, that amount was not sufficient for them to pay for the additional telecommunication cost, the additional printing cost, the marketing cost, the desk cost, putting over the iron, maybe a bit more space and so forth. But those were some of the challenges they did have. But we are taking these items that they've experienced as learning curve information, so it's possible for us to renegotiate with a typical funder like ServiceVita and to say, well, we must look at all of the components, and those components must mean that the learner and the host employer, if they're insisting that they must be SME firms, are actually able to be sustainable throughout the whole process. So we are looking to see how we can better change the program to actually create more sustainability for both host employers and the learner itself. So we're also looking at if we look to create a one learner, one phase of the empowerment fund, and so that it's possible that there will be funding specifically to a specific program, even internally. And we do have some of the other programs where there are surpluses, where we look to see how much of those surpluses can be used to actually fund more of the learners or to cover some of the gaps internally. We've had miscommunication between those employers, the lead employers, and that leads to delaying information spreading between the parties. If a learner resigns, a specific process needs to happen. And if a learner is in place, let's say they found a job somewhere else, then that process must also be communicated, and they have to go through the funder to communicate the learner number 4 is not there, and then there's someone else that needs to that process to be there. And that has been quite a challenge, because it causes frustration if someone is expecting money but he was actually not on the program to complete all the documentation. So we are busy with an audit to establish all of these learners that did actually exit from the program, what has happened with that. Now that includes looking at a poor structured interview to know what is the reason that you left. Did you find another job? Did you find the environment not conducive? There are instances where learners are sort of parachuted into a very white dominated firm, and maybe the transition is usually not that easy. And we're trying to get that information so that we can see what additional programs can we assist them with in the integration process, as we do know that quite a lot of the learners are also with white firms, and that is challenge. May have integration challenges, but it's good in every interview to have that information so they can see what are the challenges. We're also expecting that the stipend could be a challenge for them. It is quite low, even if you have an air job, because you've got traveling to do, and then it does take some time to get your first commission or your first deal. That's also how the system is working. In terms of our way forward, we have finalizing a memorandum with the African Council of Graduate Cooperatives. So they are a body that has got a lot of unemployed graduates on their database, and they also have access to funding for those unemployed youth. So for 2015-2016, the parcel of the group that we're working with is a group of 3,000 unemployed graduates and young people that they have on their database, and they will also be able to fund that allocation. So we're very excited that we actually add to our numbers. And in terms of the current project we're busy with, for the second round of the ServiceVita funding, that will also fund 1,700 young people. And we are going through the recruitment process of that, so that once funding agreements are finalized, then we're able to actually increase the allocation to the program. So the other There's also the three academies have got learners that they can bring into the program, and therefore we are working to try and complete those negotiations. So that will also be added to our allocation. Nationally, we would have to increase the awareness campaigns in the provinces working with the MECs, and I think we have made that call to some of the MECs where we're trying to have them in their own progress help us with the provinces where we're not having the best uptake, that we could have scheduled meetings with the MEC and the real estate service providers in that specific area so that they can say they've got this product or they have other products that they would like the young people to actually start working on. So I think that is really important. So we will up the awareness campaigns so we can have more places from the host employers for that large allocation that we're trying to also play. And that process is starting with the Eastern Cape and the Western Cape, where the areas are low numbers, as we're trying to roll out this process. So Eastern Cape and Western Cape will be prioritized so we can get the numbers up in terms of that. And then we'll also go to some of the other provinces where we have low numbers or very low numbers. We have been working with the community radio station, and their campaign will be increased. And we have to do specific work with the people with disability representative group so that we can find out which of the disabilities can be matched into our sector so that we know what is the match that we're working with those institutions trying to get those numbers up. I know there has been a challenge with the stipend that was offered from the service sector, and we're also working to increase that so that people with disabilities can actually get involved in the specific sector with the required support. So, Chair, this is the broad idea that we wanted to give in terms of that. We have thought of a few other detailed information that you may be interested in, and we're not sure if we maybe just allow for the questions, and then we can maybe talk through some of those additional information that we had thought could be more useful in terms of clarity. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Shatlock, for that and presentation about the One Learner, One Education program. Maybe the department would want to add before I open up to the honourable members to ask questions. And I'm hoping that the House is realizing when we convene the meeting, we might not have realized the relevance of this discussion today. But I think all of us now will realize how critical this program is in terms of what is happening in the country today. So I think when we discuss it, we need to put it into context. Department?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, we've spent some time with the entity on this project because we treat it as a strategy project. In fact, we treat it as an economic transformation initiative. Nelson and myself were talking yesterday that we need to talk to the chairperson of the economic cluster, the Foresight economic cluster, so that we can present this. I know that the department falls under the social cluster, but we have to inform the economic cluster because it is an economic transformation initiative. A number of issues that we raised with the NDT is that the management of the program has to be shipped up internally first, before we talk to the host firms themselves. We would want to see a proper structure that manages this program within EAAB, because we've received quite a number of not so positive comments about how it's managed within the entity, and we would want that part to be attended to, and we've raised it with the CEO yesterday. What we're talking about is the project management structure. I think that came out as well in the challenges, in the slide that depicts the challenges. We also acknowledge that this is an untransformed sector. Now, placing a learner to an untransformed host firm may also be a challenge because there are issues that you have to deal with there. In fact, we ask the CEO and the dean that we need to profile those learners that are leaving the program and maybe conduct exit interviews as well, because there may be some dynamics there between the interaction, in an interaction between the learner and the host firm, and perhaps we need to provide some support mechanisms to the lender who's placed in those host firms. We also ask them to give us a list of all the host firms so that we get to know who are the participants, and we're hoping that you will get that list here today, but it can always be provided to you. And we can break that list down by province, how many host firms are participating in the Western Cape, in the KZN, and we were not very happy with the participation of the Western Cape. We feel that there's a big property market here in this province. You can't have Mpumalanga outperforming Western Cape, so to speak. So we need to do something there to get the numbers up in the Western Cape. We've read that with the team. We also talk about the funding issues. The CEO raised this issue very sharply as well, that the program is not fully funded. And what constrains the entity is the current legislation. I think we're all aware that it will have to be changed. We're working on the Property Practitioners Bill, which is going to the Guardian Trust Committee. I think it's going to Foresight soon, and it will go to the Guardian Trust Committee. And this will make it possible for the
entity. Can you define that soon?
There are the timelines. I will ask the CEO to give us the specific timelines. We've been talking to each other, legal services and the CEO, about expediting the process. In fact, yesterday, the minister's legal advisor and the COO, they spent some time discussing the process, how to expedite the process, but we'll give you the exact timelines. But the significance of that legislation is that it will make it possible for the entity to do some of the things that they are not capable of doing now. But this is an old piece of legislation formed in 1976. Now, they're still constrained. Their mandate hasn't allowed them to do some of the things that they want to do. So we have to push that piece of legislation as quickly as we can, so that we can upscale the management of this program, which we think is a strategic program. Chair, those are just comments from the department.
Thanks, Chair. Chair, there's just a couple of things in addition to the attendees. You've been indicated to the, I think it's just important to contextualize it. What we must do is contextualize us within the bigger picture. So the title deed eradication program impacts on this, because what you don't want to do is to create a situation where you increase the number of estate agents, but the numbers of property remain the same. So by increasing and improving the ability to give people title, then those people then, so you're increasing the pool of estate agents, but you're also giving them opportunities to be able to transact. The second issue is that the exit strategy. I think training for the sake of training is something we must be very careful of. The point about it is, what's the exit strategy? And one of the things that we've raised, and it's something that Brian and the team have indicated that will come back to us, is, so how are we going to facilitate the ability for black-owned estate agents to be able to be nurtured and incubated? I think that's the big issue. I mean, we've got a vibrant. I mean, we've got one of the top five property markets in the world. But do we have a black estate agency? I don't think there is one that we can speak about. So that's the one issue. So can we do that? The third issue is that, particularly in relation to the state as well as government, so we've indicated, go back to Public Works in relation to your rental properties and find out who is actually, who are the state agents that are on that. Because I think what we can do is that, I mean, as a state, in various forms, public works, economic development, municipalities, those kind of things, are they putting their money where their mouth is? And I think what we need to be able to do is to be fair to ourselves. If we're not giving those opportunities and those empowerment issues, because some of these things we don't understand, and I think it's that. And then the last point was that in relation to the cooperative model, so the issue was, which you asked, and Brian's indicated that we'll look at it, can we look at cooperative model of youth property practitioners as incubator, as a form of incubation, which will allow us to be able to ensure that there's a model that allows for that. And then the last one is the rental issue. If we push in the rental, particularly the social housing institutions and those guys, because remember, state agents are not only in relation to sales of property, they're also one of the bigger sectors or bigger component part is the rental. And what is our impact and how are we managing the ability for us to be able to change the transformation around that? And I think committee members will be aware around some of the discrimination that still continues to take place within the sector. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chair, to the officials from the department. That's the presentation, colleagues, both from the EAAP and from the department. And I just wanted to open now, before we go to the next presentation, to open to members to comment, to ask questions, to ask, to clarify, and. I'm going to start with Honorable Papa and go to Honorable Ghana, go to Honorable Melezi, go to Honorable Tata, and go to Honorable Mganatalash. In that order.
Thank you, Chair. And also thank you for considering the alphabetical order, you know.
I'm a hustler.
Only a few areas. One is that this part of transformation, it brings now to the fore the element that, of transformation in this agency, this entity. And therefore, I would want to pick up a few. One of them is whether this is a willing firm, willing learner situation. Also, to establish specific areas of transformation that need to be attended, especially those that would need this committee to be involved to influence the process and expedite that transformation. And I'm also another part is the one of the mentorship, whether we are all comfortable about this amount that goes to the mentor and the one that goes to the learner, and whether there are no dissatisfactions or complaints about that. If maybe you think the 4 million will go to the mentor and another amount will go to the student, and also to establish whether these mentors are on full-time job as mentors, so that we can also establish where that is the reality. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Kana.
And thanks very much, Chair, and thanks very much for the presentation. I think this is a very good program that the EAP is creating. I need to ask on a few aspects. One relates to, call it the standardized way of training, you know, because the learners are all over the place. You know, I want to check whether there's a standard module or way of training that need to happen. And, but I myself, when I started, I started through the CITAS, the CITAS stream. And sometimes, what we have seen is that the host employer do take a learner through the learnership or the CITAS, but then after 12 months, there hasn't been much that has learned because the person was just moved from had to post, making copies, and was not really on the ground. And what I want to check, and I think PG Changan touched on it, it's a successful aspect of it, you know, whether they are successful graduates that were followed through the system, where now are on the ground and they are busy selling the houses or doing in the rental space. The other aspect is with regard to the established firms. and to what extent are the establishments doing their own intake over and above what's happening now, and whether there is commitment. Because you might know, CEO, that when you come and present, you tell us that EAP has got money. There's money there. No, it might not be your money, but the money there. Because what I hear is that the money that or the stipend that's given to the learners is mostly coming from the services sector. It's whether the money that are in the trust, call it the trust of the EAB, with the obvious mostly will come from the big estate agent firm, whether there has been some element of commitment to use that aspect. But, you know, one of the things with the learnership and teachers, the resignations, you know, you touched on resignations. One of it is that 2,500 might look a bit, someone would say, after 6 months, say, he can't, basically, you can't cope with the 2,500 that you get if you consider the transport cost. And in other instances, you know, myself, when I got that opportunity, I was from a rural area, I had to move to a small town. So, I have to get accommodation there, and then the transport costs, and there are other things. And you find that most of the resignations or the people dropping off the system is because they are actually worse off than when they are in the program. It's what extent are we going in there to check the reasons why the learners are dropping off from the program itself, and whether as the EAP together with the big firms that are contributing to your coffers. That there are discussions to supplement stipend or the money that the business is giving to those employees. And then the original slide did not indicate the host agencies. I see, as you said, that most of them are SMMEs, and obviously the big names are missing there. I mean, we know the big names in terms of EAP agencies in South Africa. To what extent are we engaging them to do their part with the money that they have? Because you know these big they do have some money. And then finally, I'm just that never I done it. The issue of the IDP houses, and we know that we are game tackling, and we know that there's quite a significant number of high number of houses that are being sold in the night market or sold illegally, and I would think that the one of the training grounds for some of these learners would be to study that market, because that's more like a low value kind of market, and it will give them the necessary experience to understand the whole process, and whether some of the learners are involved or their host employees, host companies, or I'm not sure, host companies are being involved. I know that I'm preempting the next presentation, but that's because Neville raised this issue. I think it's fair for me to ask the question whether they are being also involved in the title deed as part of learning the trade and the experience in there. Because sometimes you say we want them to be involved in the RGB stage, but then you have a title deed program, and then the host companies themselves are not involved in that program or project. So there's no call it working together or trying to link the two and try to unlock the potential of in the RDP or state subsidy houses and low value and touch on the bill around the social housing and what the involvement there is. Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you much, very much, Honorable Kana. Honorable Memezi.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I think I must join you and my colleague to say indeed this topic is coming at a correct time in South Africa. We have just been involved in checking how far we've gone in transforming our institutions. Then from what is happening in universities, where we still talk of institutions that are still 83% really white in terms of the councils there, you see, and taking their whole data. So in particular, where we are, you see. So now you have just informed us that the property market is 95% really white. So which means in spite of our 21 years as government, we still are too scared to radically transform South Africa. So we have yourselves as our technocrats to propose a radical transformation in all aspects. Now, we must start by appreciating the fact that you, as a department, you thought of this aspect of one estate agent. We must appreciate. Now, coming to the stipend, I think we must agree the stipend is it's full of legacy of apartheid. You still treat these as black people. So it can't be. It's not really acceptable. You see, it's acceptable because we, you know, from our background, you know, sometimes we tend to accept these things. That's why we sometimes now find ourselves being pushed by our children. But how do we allow university to do what they're doing? So I think you'd have to look into other means. I think my colleague has said it, to improve. For the beginning, it's fine, but this thing that we must start at, you know, less quality, you know, I know where we're staying, where I'm staying, here in Parliament, is not comparable with the quality this side. It's like we tend to be a bit understanding that the quality is for other people. So, this must be looked into because it is likely that
people that can be also forced to be like Honorable Ghana was saying,
really forcing them to even if they like this kind of build. But the stipend is not helping them to even transport themselves to work or even rent a place wherever they are. So if we can look into that. Radically, if we must assist as a quality, because indeed, like the chair was saying, it's a right platform. We must radically transform it. So we must avoid this thing. This thing is quite important. One other point, you said you wanted the exit interviews. I think that should not be a focus, because you'll be addressing water under the beach. Prevent it. We know. We were once made to say bad to other people. We know how you are treated if you happen to be one among others who are different. We already know. We pretend sometimes we don't know. Maybe what must be done, you should a regular visit, maybe give them forms regularly to indicate what are the areas of comfortability, are they getting what they are supposed to be getting on daily basis? Are they not made to clean floors, to now become cardists, become, you know, tea makers? So regularly, so some forms, certain forms, they must be able to report to you how things are moving. So in that way, you are preventative than aim for exit. I think the exit is okay, because you have not done the preventative interviews, whether by forms, signing forms, give them to indicate you feedback on your routine, how we are treated here. I think that would be the best approach on regular, maybe 3 months basis. You must know how they are treated. Some other people must even visit, so that those leaders must know that they are looked upon, how they treat these people. Which facilities do they use, even when you relieve yourself? Do they use the same facility? So those things must be going on. Otherwise, the people will leave. The other point, the possibility of using the current interns to Western Cape, taking them, those that might be flexible to come, checking if would you want to come, if you have arrangements with the estate company that can take them. You can use what is called, you don't wait, those that are available already who have maybe places of stay here, they can come. But I also agree with the other colleagues, the big companies that we know must be approached, must be told. I think we must be clear about this thing of being apologetic.
they have a duty to transform South Africa. They must not force anybody to toy, even people who don't know how to toy. You see, when they try to learn, they learn things because they don't know how to toy. So we must not be forced to toy. They must allow transformation to take this course. Otherwise, they are ending their big five industries. So I don't think we must start saying these students must go for RPPs. I want them in these big property areas, 40 million property, they must be there. They must not be given, they must not be aimed as black people. They are Africans. They are properly trained people. So there should be that understanding. They are not there to get the lesser properties, the big ones. I think that should be the focus there. But otherwise, we must appreciate this the big event. I think as a committee, we must appreciate because our involvement here, we are giving people houses, but while we're doing this, we are also trying to transform this industry. So we must appreciate what you have done. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mezi. Honorable Bada, as we are teaching you how to talk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. I didn't hear the last part, but it's fine. And thank you for the presentation. I think it's eye-opening presentation. And like you said, it's economic transformation. It's a very good initiative, Chairperson. And I think it's very important as the portfolio to monitor the progress of it, because like the presenter has said, that 95% the market that is owned by white people. And in support of what DG has said today, that this portfolio, I mean this, the very same economic transformation does not only cut on human settlement, it does cut to other portfolios. And the question I want to ask is, what are you doing, what are you doing to make sure that you link it with other portfolios? We need to know the progress and there are progress on the other side, because I believe that human settlement is running the project, but we need the lead of other projects as well. And then much as we focus on the youth, because it's youth empowerment, I would like this project to extend to other people, you know, above that youth age, because people already in the agency and that are struggling would like to get the support that we are doing to other people. They have something that the department can look into it, because for us to be able to increase our figures, we shouldn't be looking only on one market, the youth. And perhaps it's the very same reason why they cannot tolerate this market, because it's a market that is not friendly in terms of making sure that you grow into that market. And perhaps we need to have another area to help other people. And then in terms of the target as well, Chairperson, I think it's very important as the portfolio to check what is it that we're aiming at. How many people are we expecting to empower youth versus the other people that we are prepared to take on the other hand? I'm not going to be repeating what my colleagues have said with regards to other issues. And I'm glad the president did also mention in terms of the females and people with disability. But again, if you don't measure it, you won't be able to do it. So for me, the target is very important. And then in terms of the capacity, I've checked also in terms of your structure. And I'm worried because I mean, this area we want it to grow. But in terms of your structure, I would like to ask if you are happy in terms of your capacity. Are you not at the end of the day coming to the portfolio to say you are not hoping with a work because you are understaffed? I was really much concerned. And then also in terms of the... Okay, Chairperson, I would like to make a proposal to check the progress of this project. We have to get a report maybe every 3 months or to make sure that we monitor the progress as the portfolio. Thank you very much.
Are you saying you want to visit to the EAB headquarters? No, I don't want you to respond now. Honorable Ngakotas.
Thank you, Chairperson. Firstly, I just want to deal with the issue of training. because these clinics at universities are only funded by government covers. But the people that receive, that benefit from the qualified personnel is the private sector. South Africa is the only country that doesn't have a private sector contributing in training of students at university level. And I think it's high time now that we look at that, all of us led by, of course, would be led by the Department of Higher Education and Economic Department and Department of Labor and all other stakeholders. But as we are here as human documents, we can also make a contribution. My call is that we call upon the Health Agent Board to make a contribution at that level. Because health agents are the ones that benefiting more than the government in terms of the personnel being employed. Even in other fields, generally, it's the private sector that benefits more than in terms of the employment. Now, the funding model in relation to sponsorship, you must sponsor students at a training level first. That we can see that then you are serious about contributing because at the end it benefits the poor students in particular. Yes, in general, and Africans in particular. We want to see clearly those ratio of a student being funded at a first year at university throughout, whether is at the FTV or whatever level of tertiary education. But also, we would want to know how many have passed. We have given us the number of interns that have been in your intake in 2013, 2014, but you haven't given us the number of students that have passed or graduated from the program of the internship, on the internship program. But what is more important for me is to get the number of students that have been able to enroll and pass the examination with the professional body. Because in most cases, that's where the problem is with these professional bodies. When we as blacks were excluded, it was very easy for everyone to pass. Come the inclusion of black people, the examination are so hard, so that you limit the number of black people that are going to pass those examinations, in particular African people, because they are the ones that are with disadvantage. There are allegations that have been going on for years that engineers, African engineers, are made not to pass those exams for professional bodies. And it might happen that other bodies are really involved in that. So we need to tap in those as well. So we would want to know the number of those. And if they are failures, why? The number, as I say, page 14, the number of intakes in the same case are disappointing. There's a booming market here. International property owners, they are owning millions of each property that is worth more than 3 million, 4 to 40 million. And the number of intakes is lesser. That tells us that environment in Cape Town, in the Western Cape, is still that. And one transformation in the Western Cape. It can't be like it's another country within a country. Whenever we want to implement policy, it becomes a country within a country. We have one country here, South Africa. No.
Can you please allow me to check?
I understand you would like to share each other, but please allow me to share.
The results are here. Now, I'm saying that if you would like to see the needs of all citizens in town, you don't want to see that it's nice to be a province, but you want to break down on the riches, the big town. Johannesburg is prepared, you can see that it's open, you can see Johannesburg, you can see Pretoria, you can see everywhere. When it comes to other provinces, you don't. You don't see the list of all cities and town clearly. And in KZN, the Deben, but include Johannesburg, include Richards Bay, include the market. Yeah. So that's just an example. In terms of the program as well, I noted my colleagues have covered that we need a feedback quarterly on the program of the internship by the interns themselves and have a way of monitoring that as well. You are agreed with one another. Always not put Africans at the end. Just list as alphabetical. There was a tendency of putting those apartheid dates where we will always put at the end. In the democracy, use alphabetical order where Africans will start with A. You let's follow that. And if we don't want to see ourselves at the end, like you are forbidden to be inferior all the time. The section is the bottom slide. Separate your numbers are given us for Johannesburg and Port Elizabeth, 45. Please separate those numbers. We want to know how many for Johannesburg and how many for BG. I think I've done separate this. Thank you. And of course, most of them. But the last one is the target for Black Homes Restoration Department has mentioned that we want to emphasize as the Kokolo Committee that we, if you deal with the transformation, it can't be in 22 years of democracy. We are still saying there are very few, there are two, there are five. What are you doing about it? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Ramadan. So you, I think colleagues can notice that we are dealing with a transformation issue. So you will forgive us if here and there you say that we're becoming a bit, but that's how this issue is all about. Before I hand over to the EAB to respond, I think one thing that we need to be clear about is that the report is dealing with though they are both youth programs. The program that has been that was introduced on October 20th, if I understand the report correctly. And that program is the one that has absorbed 6,167 in Haiti. And then there's a program that was introduced in Haiti in 2015, which is the One Estate Agency. And this program has an intake of 798. Sounds correct. Now, I think we must not run out from this fact that the first program is the program that is the estate agents themselves are the one that are absorbing the income. And therefore, whatever they might be giving them is better than what the students getting on the second program. I need to be correct on that in terms of that. The second program, which is started in June, is where the rate of the dropout is, if I'm correct. Because this program is the one that the service sit down is funding. Am I correct? And this is the program where a lot of university graduates are not attracted to it, because the stipend here is 2,500, and the stipend on the intern is 1,500. Now, I think we need to be honest with each other. If I am a university graduate and I am presented to this program, why would I choose the second one and not the first one, when the first one is better aspect than the second one? What is it that we need to do as the sector to normalize the situation? Why do you think a graduate must go to this that is giving you 2,500 and then another one that is giving better than 2,500? And I think the EAA needs to deal with that clearly and find ways of how then to make both of these programs attractive, both of them, so that we can then attract more young people. I'm just saying it. We need to agree here, both the department and the AAB, that if this project and this program is managed well and it is marketed well, this program can do a lot in terms of releasing pressure, both from government and the community out there, in terms of, one, unemployment of young people, but as well as killing of young people. But moreover, even the universities themselves will find a breathing space if this program is managed well. What we need to agree upon, that question of willing expectations, I think we need to unpack it. Is it up to them if they don't want to take students? There is no penalty. They can just do as they want. If they don't want to have the students or interns in their companies, nothing happens. It's well as usual. There's nothing. There's no... So it's up to them. If they feel like, they must. If they don't feel like, they can't. What are we doing as this sector? What is it exactly that we have to do? Why do you want to allow transformation to depend on the will of an individual who has never transformed in the first place? What do you think today is going to change them to suddenly become champions of transformation? There should be ways that you try and nudge them and push them to transform. What is it that you're doing? And I think those are the hard questions that we should ask ourselves and deal with them and be able on the other side, make sure that we don't alienate them at the same time, because we need them to actually deal with this process. But I thought it's important that we don't beat about the bush in terms of trying to deal with. We are dealing with a very tricky issue here. It's transformation. It is not going to be comfortable to everybody. Don't expect it to be comfortable for everybody, but it needs to be done. And we need to make sure that we push on doing it. So that at the end of the day, we create a better country and better young people that are healed. It is not going to be comfortable to do that. And I think at this point in time, where you are handling this program, you are handling it with kid class. We are not going to move anywhere. I think find another strategy. And for me, you need to go back to the drawing board and find another strategy of how you can actually make sure that you improve the program faster and quicker, and make sure that it deals better. For now, it's not really helping much in terms of trying to do what you want to do. It's a noble cause, but nothing is. It's not yielding what we want to do. So maybe you can respond, and then we can see how we move forward.
Thank you, Jay. And Jay, I must say, it's a different morning for me. It is the kind of support that we were looking for, and it's very clear that the passion in the portfolio committee behind this program is evident, and it is the kind of trust, I think, that we need to see. I love the ideas and the questions, because these are all designed to actually take us much more forward. And I'm sad to say that the first question from the first honorable member was probably the one that hit this team in the nail on the head, the willing, third willing learner concept. I think that is the fatal flaw as it is, and I think it's important for us to understand how we got ourselves into that situation. So I don't want to continue going back to the Act, but let me rather say what we're doing about it. In the new bill, it is making the property charter a compulsory compliance. And there's not a lot of charters. There is, most charters are just voluntary. But this one saying that you must comply with the property charter. Now, in the property charter, again, it is giving the thresholds for transformation and it's giving us that powerful tool that we can use. Where do we want to be? We want to be at the place where you say, if you are not transforming, if you are not actually complying with that, we cannot give you a license to trade. That's where we need to come. Now, current legislation doesn't give us that tool, so I think that is why I think the DG and the Department of the Military, it was working hard to get that new obsolete processes. And I think that is going to give us a lot of relief. So, correct, it is currently where a willing estate agent is saying, I am looking to bring people in, and a willing learner said, I want to be part of the process. And I think that is where the traction challenge is. It will get better, obviously, when we implement the bill, but it's not saying that we mustn't deal with the challenge that we do have. In terms of the amounts paid, a mentor is a current estate agent. So he's currently working there, he's been there for 3 years, in fact he's a business owner mostly, or he's got people that have been there, he's got such a lot of experience with him. So he's currently very much invested into this, and therefore he's saying, in the ordinary course, I am taking this learner under my wing, but they do this not just for this program, this is how we are structured. It is like that, that a lawyer has got candidate, a lawyer in article classes, so they've got estate agents, they've got full estate agents, and they've got interns. So it is in the ordinary course that they are giving them the training, so they are very much invested in it. I want to say that there is a specific logbook that is being completed on a daily basis to deal with all of the working objectives to make sure that it's not possible for you to be subjected to making photocopies and making tea and those kind of things. There is a physical logbook that has been designed to track the record of the individual's performance and learning. And then also, the training is also not training that has just been given, to the CAB. What has happened is, for you to do the MPS4 qualification, it has to be the accredited one from Service Sector from SACWA. So it's got real standards that give us professional designation. Currently, there's only about 11 firms that have been accredited by Service Sector training firms. So it means we have to draw from those 11 accredited firms, and then we find who are the ones who've got a national infrastructure, who've got capability to train all of the learners consistently so everyone get that training, so they're on that kind of program where they're actually going through a very guided training process. In terms of the adjustment, I think to be so that log, I think, is very important. It does help us. Your standard training in NQF4, NQF5 training from people that are accredited. We would like to see that more of the real estate qualifications are actually present in TVET colleges, so there is more options. But currently it is 11 private sector firms, and again there, when you're looking at Service Sector firms, not all of them are transformed like we would like to see, so it gives us very little small pool of what we can actually use from them. Now I do have a slide here, just to give a bit of a breakdown, and I think you have seen it. In terms of the structure, I agree with the members that we have to rework the structure. We want to have the size of this. We are going to have to add more capacity so that we can have a bigger spread and more have more impact in the various provinces. This is giving us previously how the private sector had absorbed individuals, and this is what the member is asking, but let's break it down to see in housing the 4,500, who are the large firms that have done that. Chair, maybe I'm jumping a little bit around. Just important to know that the private sector are absorbing young people into ordinary boards. In fact, they're not giving them a basic salary, they're not giving them a commission, not a stipend. That young person has got the capability to come in there and carry himself for about 3 months before his first commission comes. And that is why we needed to have another program. So they are actually getting more on the offtake if you're in the funded program, because at least you've got the stipend to bring you to work and so forth. The ordinary estate agent just comes there, you've got resource, and I think that is also not addressing the property issue. And that's why we have to have a funded program. And I do agree with members that the current funding model is inadequate. So we have to look at legislative change again to deal with the EAB's tight hand currently, where the Consumer Protection Fund has got limitations. We want to be able to fund this so we can appear in that, so we can track and really assist the young people who are currently in dire need to come and not find themselves in a worse position when they come into the program. So that provincial program is giving to us, again, the number, and we can hear this. So we will come back with more details in terms of this, who are the firms, and what have the large firms actually been doing. I will say part of the lack of visibility of the large firms in slightly to give an additionally is because we are working and waiting for a private sector, for a CETA funded program or any GFI, because it takes so long, business wants to continue on. And that's why they said as soon as this program was launched for the first time, still the same program, one learner program, they said we're going to start absorbing young people. So they did that in the ordinary course, because the cost of the funding was always there, but instead they continued with it. But we want to see them actually continue significantly more with them, and that's why we did not see a lot of the large names here. We did receive a lot of pledges from all of the large firms, and I'd say some have followed through with their pledges, with the numbers that we've seen, not even waiting for the funding and for the funded program, but we have to continue knocking on the doors to every single year have that application, otherwise we are not going to see the percentages change. I think this will wake up for us to see the fees must fall. We are going to find that young people are going to say, want to see change. 60% of all young people that are renting, that are buying, it's our people. We are the buying power. If you look at the Democratic South Africa, the buying power is here. A big challenge that we have, except for this legislative change that we're doing, unfortunately in this market, a buyer or a tenant is just looking for that property. He is not the individual that's the one presenting it to, but we as buyers have to, in South Africa, start saying, I'm looking for transformation. For this year, I'm going to pay for this house I would like to be served by a service provider who's an estate agent. Then others are not going to see that. And currently there's only 5% black estate agents fees with own firms, and even the agents are also too little in terms of that. So there have been some discussions with the Department of Public Works, specifically through our chairperson, who's had meetings with the minister there and the DG. The purpose of that was we wanted them to integrate the list of young black people into their service provider list. We have submitted that information to them. But again, as we add more people, we have to continue saying that thing. But I think I love what Mr. Chen and the DG are saying, is if we as the department with us can have better support there to actually create that, so that the public works can say their first port of call will be to use those young people in those big rental agreements. Those are large buildings, and that is a big commission that will make a huge difference in the life of the young people. So we'll definitely use that. I think the fruit of the if we can come back with to say what has happened with those previous intakes, how far did they go through the process, where are they now? I don't want to now give some indication of ratios. They let us sort of go and analyze that, come back and say in our quarterly report is a committee field, so that we can keep on tracking what happened with those. Did we lose them? Did they stay? What happened with them? Did we actually deal with them? So that we see, are they the ones now selling it deep? Are they selling it the beach front, or have been put in the more poor areas? What is it that they understand where they are actually going to? I think our LVAB would like to be more on the forefront of funding, carrying out our limitation of activities, what we can do, but for us to actually provide more education, that is the area that we should be building, and we should be having more allocation of young people that we think we're giving stipend and education for, and we're paying for that, so that we can actually have some of that we're not so dependent and then limited by our current legislation as we are. The gatekeeping principle has been a challenge, and I think we've sort of cleverly created and applied that the EAB comes from professional body. And that was, and we know that all of the private sector organizations were trying to apply to become the professional body for the real estate sector. We took that gap to the regulator so that we could be that body that will make sure there will be no gatekeeping. And I think that is a very important tool. We'll come back and see how many of the interns have gone through the various years, have actually passed it, and analyze why they failed, why are they passing, so forth. And maybe just also, we'll come back to maybe provide further details on the numbers, where all of the cities are, who's operating in the cities, and who is in the rural areas. And also to try and track from them, I mean, how many deals did they do in the period? If they were operating for 1 year, they did one deal. But one big gain farm, great. But I mean, if it is only one small house, that means it's not sustainable. But for us, try and get those stats, so we can actually start presenting that kind of items. Thank you, Chair. So I've tried to just cover all of the in quite broad terms. Yeah. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much.
Professor, you want to your last word on this before we move to the next one?
I just wanted to express gratitude here, because I think the responses that we've received actually underline the gaps that are there and the work that we still need to do. I can just mention, for instance, the I think the issue raised by the Memezi, because I think that is very important. We need to be able to have a tracker system to check if the kids are happy in the program. What are the problems they are experiencing? In other words, the point which was underlined by Honorable Nenez is about a monitoring evaluation system, something we need to build into this program so that it can give us information about what needs to be strengthened, what needs to be revised, what needs to be improved. The issue of quarterly status reports, I think, is also very useful. We need to inform members about the progress of this particular project. The other issue about speeding up the legislative change, because the legislation we are using is very tedious. A 1976 legislation, which is very old and out of step with development in South Africa. Contributions by the estate agents to funding the training of these kids has been raised by the honorable member, and I think it's an important contribution. But I must underline, though, that there is a bit of resistance within the estate agency sector. Some of them would have preferred self-regulation rather than being regulated by government. So the sooner we move with legislative amendments, the better. So I'm very grateful for the contributions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I allowed a lot of time for this report to be debated. Don't expect that the next two reports are going to have plenty of time. But I think it was critical for us to actually give more time on this one. We, on closing it up, we can all agree that EAB and the portfolio committee, we have a quarterly date with you. You will be coming to us every 3 months without fail. So that we start to like each other more. thank you very much. The next report that we had asked is about the identity. You're doing it. Yeah, the department and the AP are doing that jointly. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair members. Thanks for the opportunity. I think DG has just stepped up. I'll try and be brief. I'll do the first part, and Anton from the EAB, Anton Arnazer from EAB will do the balance. Chair, just give us an indication of what the presentation outline is. Chair, since the initial pronouncement, particularly post this term of office, political office, you know that from the mandate together with the minister's announcement that there's been a focus in relation to the alignment of resources attached to the project. I think what we're indicating is that particularly for this project to be a success, the importance is about the funding, the project management and the secretariat. Chair, the issue is that in relation to the funding, we've managed to resolve that. So where we are is that we've confirmed, particularly with National Treasury, that the HSDD will and is funding the registration backlog. There will be in the 2016-2017 specific targets attached to the title deeds backlog. But those backlogs are in relation to the eradication, and Anton will deal with some of the numbers in relation to that. If there are any shortfalls, both the provinces and the metros, particularly from the USDG, will procure any additional capital expenditure. We're not expecting that. So I think it's just important to note for the committee and yourself that. As a result of the importance and the strategic political significance of the project, there's decidedly hands-on support by the National Department of Human Settlements in relation to the program management and the support. say the overall accountability in relation to this resides with the National Minister together with the Department of Human Settlements, and that the Accounting Office, the Acting DG. In support of that, we've agreed that EAAB will avail project management and secretarial support. The official reporting line based on the strategic importance, obviously, that's the DDG, and that's the strategy and planning. Then institutional arrangements, just to indicate, I think what we want to indicate is that we want to leave the portfolio committee and yourself with a sense of understanding, but also comfort that this project is being driven and being managed to be able to achieve those outcomes. And I think particularly given the importance of title deeds, not only in relation to security of tenure, but its economic impact, as we've indicated, in relation to what the other impact knock-on effects are. You'll see, Chair, particularly in relation to this, the reporting Minister and Technical Minmec and Minmec. There's a National Steering Committee that is chaired by the DDG, being myself, the 9 Provincial Steering Committees. The project team consists of the National Department of Human Settlements and the EAAB with their expertise and technical support. There's logistic support in terms of contract management, PRPs, from the department, and then the institutional support. And I just want to indicate, Chair, that through the support of the Acting DG, we've had excellent support. In fact, the Chief Surveyor General, as well as the Chief Deeds Office, in fact, the Chief Registrar, of Deeds is now a permanent attendee to our implementation forum to oversee this project. And then also the DG for Rural Development and Agri Reform has also placed an importance on this, so we'll indicate that. Chair, I'm going to hand over to Anton just to give us what the registration so the committee and yourself can get an understanding of where we are. We'll go through this quickly, but I think it's just important that you get an understanding of what we have and understand that we've got to handle on those issues.
Thank you very much, well, that also, at least for one, the presentation now, Honorable Ganayula, through is that it has moved a step forward. At least we can see that there is structure in this, because all the time that the department was coming to us was just diversity. Identity. It has become a national anthem. It has become a national anthem. It is now becoming a toy boy. So then we have moved there, therefore.
Thank you, Chair. Before I move, just to amplify one or two points that Nero has made in respect of the institutional arrangements. The funding for this comes from the HSDT, the Human Settlements Development Grant, and there's specific rules that determine how the grant is used. Not only going forward, and now I'll elaborate on that in subsequent slides, not only will we going forward be using the HSDG and the projects for the eradication of title deeds will be reflected in a business plan, but will also be reflected and subsumed as part of departmental reporting. So I think that's a further point that really needs to be emphasized. And certainly not in any way wanting to negate the EAAB's responsibility towards the project, but I think it's important to understand that the department going forward will be reporting on progress and progress in respect of the legislation backlog. Honourable Chair and members, the remainder of this presentation presumes that revolving on the first presentation made to this committee a few months ago. So we won't go into the objectives, the mandate, the purpose of the project, and we won't talk about why titling is not happening. All of that has been covered, so we need to assume that as the basis. Point of departure, 2010 talks about so many titles having been, or so many houses have been built, but only half of those having been registered. And this, what the slide attempts to show is subsequent to that, we did a similar exercise and looks at and the red line talks about the houses having been delivered, and the green line talks about title having been registered. Well, over the last 5-year period, what we find is that in fact there's been an increase in terms of the ratio of title having been registered versus houses having been built. So it has gone up from 49% to just under 61% over the last five financial years. So so that's good news, but less so. If one looks again at specifically the last financial year, there was specific number of houses delivered, and again, if you look at the registrations, it hovers at around 50 or just over 50%. So there is work that has been done, but the remains, shall we call it, room for improvement. Chair and members, this slide probably is the springboard. Since the inception of the project, and we consider the inception of the project the announcement made by the Minister in her budget speech of July 2014, you see that in that first year of financial year, there had been a delivery of a total of 27,000. Alright? For the current financial year, provinces have set the target of 58,000, of which just over 32,500 have already been delivered. Okay, so that figure of 32,600 as at September. So for this financial year already, we're very confident that the targets that have been set by provinces will be exceeded. I mean, if we look particularly, and again to raise the emphasis of P94 spot, you see there that the target was just over 6,000 already, the provinces have already exceeded that target. So this slide tells two stories though. Alright? While it talks about delivery improving over the last financial year, I think this number should also be placed in the context of what the backlog is. I'm going to get to the slide now, but I think it's again important to understand what the funding arrangement and where the funding is coming from to deal with the eradication. We've talked about, and Cheney has said that this comes from the HSDG, the Human Settlements Development Grant. And I think it's in the context of that that one needs to understand that this project is in fact contesting for limited funding and financial resources in order to deal with that the registration backlog.
Just on this slide here, what we indicated was that from the portfolio side, together with Minister, the technical member, and MinMec, is we'll just give a handover schedule. We did request the provinces to indicate to us. Those don't necessarily reflect what the for example, in the Eastern Cape, that refers to Bathurst City, NMBM, you know, that's Nelson Mandela Bay Metro, Free State, Gauteng, Northwest and Limpopo. Chair, what I have requested is that through the acting DG, we requested that we be provided with a schedule. So on a quarterly basis, we can give the portfolio committee and members where exactly these title deeds are, what they are. I think it's important to note that in relation to when there's a title deed launch, and members will be aware, then what happens is that the municipality or the province calls a number. So it's not the total number that gets given out, but on an annual, on a daily basis, their title deed. What we asked for is that we get those numbers on a monthly basis. If our logistics allow, we'll try and get that done on a monthly basis. So we'll be able to track on a daily basis what title deeds have been issued by the deeds, what is within municipalities and provinces, what's being collected and what's outstanding, because that's one of the big issues around it, and also what's the number of title deeds around in the townships and which are those townships. So we'll be able to give you, I think we've got that. So from a portfolio chair, we'll make that available to yourself, and you can distribute that to two members of where exactly these ceremonies are and handovers. And obviously, I think there will be encouragement of us to be able to assist and also through our education campaigns through Parliament to also improve that. Thanks, Anton.
Okay. So, So the question sort of looks a whole big business backlog. Our latest figures suggest that it's standing at around 776,000, and the 776,000 includes both pre and post 94 stock. What we are currently in the process of doing, we just recently, around a month or 6 weeks ago, received the latest deeds records, and along with the provinces, are now in the process of reconciling what is on the HSS and what is in the deeds registry, in order that we are now able to come up with a finite and an absolute number. So, that number, we can start printing and imprinting that number of 776,000. So, where we are present, a very quick synopsis. We are of the view that while registrations have increased, a significant backlog remains, and we are making inroads. I've talked about the backlog, the registration backlog, and we're in the process of scrubbing those numbers now. We are mindful of the recurring backlog, and I will talk about this in a few slides and what the department has done and in the process of concluding. And then, finally, we are saying that notwithstanding the inroads, the commitments to the eradication of the backlog needs to be considered, notwithstanding the targets that have been set by provinces. So, I've given you an indication of what the problem, what has been done in terms of the project. We've talked about institutions, we've talked about delivery to date, and we've talked about some of the encumbrances. So where to from here? Firstly, in respect of the funding, what we have done, and this is on request from the National Treasury, we needed to provide an indicative number of how much it's going to cost to deal with the registration backlog. So this is a figure of 776,000. And what now has been done, we've taken some random samples of projects that have already been undertaken across the country, from the Western Cape to the Northwest to the Eastern Cape, of how much it costs on average per project or per site to effect deal with restoring title and issuing title. Okay, now, obviously, not every single project needs the same remedial action. Right, but so what we have done is look at a range of projects and worked on an average, and that average stands at around 1,800. And then if you do the quick sums of multiplying those two numbers, you get to an estimated cost of around 1.4 billion. Right. We've begged and pleaded with National Treasury, and unfortunately, and it was confirmed in the mini budget of last week, there is no new money, and it has not been confirmed that that 1.4 billion will come from the HSBG. Moreover, Technical Mimic has agreed and supported the decision that 1.4 billion be specifically ring-fenced, and it will be stated in the grant framework for the HSBG for the remaining three financial years. And in essence, what is said is, what is meant, is that 1.4 billion will be reserved for nothing other than dealing with the registration backlog. We've already provided tentative figures to the National Treasury, and it is important to note that they have supported this intervention. So, in essence, in short, what we've now done is one of the ways in which we're giving traction is making sure that the funding to deal with the eradicating the backlog is now being confirmed and is reserved. A breakdown of that of what exactly that would be, there's that figure of the backlog in 776,000, there's the figure of 1.4 billion, and these are therefore the indicative amount of how much will be reserved per province. And it's important to note here that is the figure that very likely will be broken down over a 3-year period, so this isn't a once-off. So in the case of Gauteng, it's 300 million. Very likely it would be broken down over 3 years, so that's not 300 million per annum.
Chair, I think this way the committee's and your reports is no one's going to come back to us and say to us, we don't have money to do this. Is there, it's been ring-fenced, it's available,
and the work must be done. So, and we're going to monitor that. So the money's there, it's been ring-fenced, we've done the footwork for them, but as Anton will indicate, it's not that we've only done that. We will do the work for them if they don't do it.
Chair, there are two slides in your presentation. I'm looking to get into the detail of each of them. Neville's talked about the National Steering Committee and the nine provincial steering committees. Those committees are meeting on a regular basis to talk about specifically the work that is being undertaken. These just provide you a synopsis of what each of the provinces have been doing in order to make sure that they now have the necessary in place. So with the exception of Limpopo, all of the provinces have now established a confirmed panel of conveyances to deal with these registrations. And happy to report that many of those registrations, and you've seen it in the numbers, are already now underway. The second thing that many of the provinces already have in common is that they have also started appointing external service providers to run with these projects specifically provinces such as the Northwest. In the case of KZN, they partnered with the HDA to do a lot of the land legal issues, deal on a lot of the land legal work. In the case of the Northwest, they've brought in some of the PRTs to come alongside of their PPU to run with the project. So in all of the provinces, GM members happy to report that we're getting a very good sense that institutionally the necessary structures and expertise are now being brought on board to give action to the project. The above notwithstanding, we are now in the process the provinces are currently, as we speak, in the process of developing detailed implementation plans for the remaining three financial years in a way in response to dealing with their respective backlogs. You see there, we set the deadline for the end of November, and I'll come to that deadline and why the significance of that deadline. And in essence, what is expected in these implementation plans. I've talked about the backlog. We need to be very specific where these backlogs are per category, what are the causal factors per municipality, determine the nature and extent of each of them, and then also talk about the institutional and capacity constraints. Then, in respect of the plan itself, for the remaining three financial years, what are the costs, what are the time frames, what are the deliverables. Putting all of that together then, I've talked about the backlog and we've set the absolute deadline by the end of October. So come next week, we are in a position to know exactly what the numbers are. In end of November, the provincial implementation plans will be received by the National Department. Those numbers and those targets get fed directly into the annual plans of the provinces for the remaining three financial years. So, again, if one understands the conditionality of the HSDG, there are going to be very specific projects that are listed in those business plans, and against those projects, specific deliverables are expected and specific funding cash flows will be delivered upon. Jay, you recall we talked about some of the causal factors in our initial presentation, and I'm not going to repeat this. I think the slide, you may recall the slide. The department made a few policy recommendations a few years ago, and it certainly isn't the intention to reconsider those. Some of those reasons were really valid, but there have been unintended consequences, and they relate specifically to the ability of the department to register title. In response, what is currently what we're in the throes of confirming now are ministerial policy directives. And the first one is the most telling one. that before the NHVRC signs off on a house as having been completed and delivered, the developer, and the developer being either the province or the municipality, will need to have demonstrated that they would have issued an instruction to a conveyancer to register the title. Okay? These recommendations are done as a way of precluding the recurrence of the backlog. Right, so that is underway. We are just awaiting final sign-off and agreement. But in principle, support has already been provided by the NHVRC. Chair, there are two more slides before I hand over to level to close. I think it's important, and this is in response, not necessarily directly in response to one of the questions raised about the importance of providing stock, etc., etc. We are in conversation with the Department of Rural Development around the issue of registration of title. In short, there's a view that is held that the transactional cost and the complexity of the process of registering title may in fact be too complex and too costly for those operating in the affordable and subsidized market. And as a consequence thereof, you're finding, people refer to it as illegal transactions, others refer to it as informal transactions, depending on your point of view. So it costs too much to transfer property formally, it costs too much to register property, and as a result, it's an informal transaction that takes place and gets stamped by the local commission of oath, the local station commander, etc., etc. What we are saying here, simply with these two slides, is we need to have a look at the institutional structures that supports registrations and transactions, because I don't want short of saying an exercise in futility, it is important that we register title, but if we don't have those institutional systems in place that support transactions at the lower level, you will still find that notwithstanding our project to restore title, subsequent transactions may still be informal. So that's something we just need to guard against. DDD, I'm going to hand over to you.
Thanks, Jim. Chair, I think just to indicate, in closure, and these are the critical success factors, I think what we didn't want to do is to come and tell you what the problem was. We know there's a problem, and what we've told you is this is the problem, this is how we're going to fix it, this is the time frame, and all is accountable for that. And I think that's what the DG, acting DG and minister are. So the issue is the critical success factors. These are issues which I think you should take into consideration. But these are particularly, I think the important thing is just going forward is the last one is ministerial policy directive that precludes the recurrence. We think, and we're pretty sure that we can clean this backlog, but we don't want it to recur. The important thing around this is that they will, we know that provinces, and we've indicated to provinces, well, you know, the issue is, well, should, after the, you know, lodgement before the NHPRC, if we're so efficient, if we've got all this technological advancement, and all the synchronizing that's occurring, and we know that, then we should be able to do better. And I think this is the one program which I think we can demonstrate with all its legality, with all its complexity, that we can expedite it. So I think those are the issues. I think Mac and DG would want to just comment on a couple of things, but if they are. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, for that presentation. Over to you, Chairman.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you very much to the department for this presentation. I think it's given some clarities somehow, but I think I must say I'm still left with a lot of questions. Maybe you'll have to break down your backlog into provinces and then municipalities. From where I sit, it does not tally with the townships that I know were put up throughout municipalities. So it's leaving out a lot. You see, the numbers that we are giving, I'm not convinced that they reflect the real backlog. You see, if you were to say that's in Lengu Lane alone, you say a twat, Binoni, so it does not, to me, I think these numbers, you must still go and check them properly if they are reflecting what we have done. You can go, that's not happening, the problem. On the amount that you are reimbursing for this administration, feeling like we're taking now more money that was supposed to give us more houses to administration. I'm of the view that feel like we're paying more. Remember, the administrative work, we have administrators that we have employed, which is yourselves. And not only yourselves, we have a duplication of yourselves at provincial levels, duplication of yourself in municipalities. Not only yourselves as yourself, we even have lawyers at all levels. And that we are paid monthly. And they said to us when we were interviewing them that they are equal with us, they can run the course. No, it's like all the time you must go out and pay other people. This is to do the same work that we thought you can do. But also, you know, that's why the presentation to me is not really making me very happy. From 94 onwards, when we were determining putting up townships, we were determining the with cost already. Everything was paid, the township is registered, you know. There are lots of processes that we entered into when we put up a township and registering all those processes. And I believe we were paying all these years. Each year there's financial cost, each quarter there are financial costs. Now it is like we didn't pay, now we must now pay again. Maybe there's something that is tricking me not to understand what you know. You see, what we have been doing all these years. You see, doing the same. So that's why then this presentation is really tricking me, because we have been dealing with this kind of work. But I'm still not sure if it's really dealing with the problem. In particular, where all the people that are giving houses must be registered, even those that are applying, we must be able to check if we have not given them houses in KZN, in Audin, in Libobo. So I'm still not sure if we are fixing that side of things to ensure that we are not tricked by people who move around it. So the presentation from where I sit, the numbers just don't make me happy. The finances arrangement is promising, but I think we are putting more money for financing what we can reduce by using ourselves and then focus it on the product, which is housing. I think that's my concern, but I think there's something we're given, but it looks like when I look on the ground in each municipality across South Africa, there's too many houses that that's for where to alone, or let me use a black township, Kahiso, in Mohale. So there are various projects there that were put. There are so many houses than you are showing here. I'm talking about one small town. So I'm saying maybe there's something that you need to explain. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much.
need to deal with that trigger of honorable members.
Thank you, Citizen. Just three issues for me because I know my colleague is going to raise something. But just to add on what Honorable Menele has said, even though I don't feel trapped, but on the issue of pre-1994, I think for me that is very crucial because perhaps you need to break it down to say the pre-1994, what is the progress up to now? But I think what we need to do, especially the department, what needs to be done there is to make sure that you build the capacity to make sure that we resolve all those issues pre-1994. Because if you don't resolve them, and I want to agree with Honorable Minister to say, he does not give the presentation, does not tell us to say post-1994 what is the progress. And my issue is that I so wish that at least after 1994, especially with the recent the owners of the houses, I don't wish we can fast-track the issue of the title deed so that we don't add it to the current backlog. So I think for me that is very important. And then the issue that I want to focus on, which for me is very crucial, and I want to agree with the Honourable Minister to say, they have a hand for 1.4 billion rent that has been ring-fenced, and that money will be taken from the HSBC. I think we shouldn't believe, I mean, losing your focus as the portfolio, because the Minister has consent, in fact has committed to say, she wants to make sure that come end of the term, 1.5 million housing opportunities. And now, if we are refencing 1.4 billion rand, it means that the money that was supposed to have created new housing opportunities will be used, that money, for title deeds. And that is not a new opportunity. So I'm very much concerned about that 1.4 that should be refenced from the HSCG. And what should be the impact? Because if I'm going to take 1.4 billion, that was meant to create new opportunities, then what's going to happen in terms of the target of the department to say, want to create 1.5 million of housing opportunities come in, I mean, end of the financial term. Thank you, Sir.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Chair, and thanks for the presentation. I mean, the first thing that stood out, like Honorable Tata said, is the 1.4 billion. And I need to be clarified about whether the 1.4 is already in there in the plan, because I don't recall seeing it in the plan for the department. I think you were talking about top slicing, like get done with other programs, and what the impact of that is. I say this because I just did my own calculation, the average cost of the data stack out. We're talking about people take 9,000 houses are not going to be built. And if you look at the NPF target, whether we are we are leaving behind in terms of our delivery delay of property houses. So that it's a huge concern for me. It's also a huge concern for me. Where what the impact of that 1.4 billion is for what HSBC was initially for. Next, the other aspect which you did not touch on, which I saw on the maybe if I'm reading this was incorrect, there was a proposal that to withhold the final payment tranche when we build the state city house. Is it a payment to the contractor? And whether what we are envisaging is that the contractor, as part of the contract, should be part of getting the or doing the entire aspect of things. That's another one. If you can just clarify what you presented now, you did not touch on it. And that's a issue for me in terms of what the model is. And if for instance, the big office is not coming to the party, so now the contract, the whole job is actually to build the house, well then there will be little disadvantage in not getting the payment because of the inefficiencies of other departments that are not necessarily his or her fault. I mean, if you build a house and so on, we build the house. Maybe we need to look at it and explain. The numbers themselves, like Honorable Members say, they are too low to be believed. I mean, if we say the president slumped it that we have provided over 3 million housing opportunities and so forth, it's 2.7. 3.7.
No.
The president said 3.7. So if the president said that, then it's 3.7. And we say, does this mean that 3 million of those houses have title? If we say the backlog is 672, it means 3 million has got title. I'm not sure if that's believable. I'm not so sure whether you believe that's the accurate state of affairs. I say this because even with this new program that's introduced, even with this new program now, the houses that are built last year, only 33-34% got title. But then now, if you're saying that 3 million already got title because your backlog is sitting at 332, then I find it very hard to believe that that's the actual number. So I ask, how did you arrive at that number? How did you come to that number of 672? And then on the slide around establishment of a township, is it the technical establishment, or because I would presume that safeties are already in there, like your water, your electricity, and the municipalities to go and collect the whatever they call it, the rubbish and so forth, which means in a municipal end, the township is already established. That's why there are services there, that's why there's electricity and so forth. So why do we still want to spend money on establishing a township? Please clarify me so that I'm clear when I leave here. What the technical aim of establishing a township is, and then finally on the ownership contestation, and I look at that 1,800, and I say that figure, it might work when it's a new house that we're talking about. But then if there are contestations and then you're involving lawyers and so forth, is it not too conservative? Just looking at the contestation, because I think the contestation is just going to be a massive amount. If you can just clarify me how you're going to handle the ownership contestation aspect. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much,
Thanks, Jefferson. The consent remains a clock. Your target was October 2015. And I'm proposing, Jefferson, that by end of February, that exercise should have been completed. Give an extension from November to end of February 2015. We cannot go beyond that because we are going for local government elections. When the politicians were campaigning, we said we will produce title deeds. We really go to our people, they are going to ask us where are our title deeds. And by then, want to have all the answers. I'm not going to be speaking about the on that. So by end of February, we should get all the information. Having said that, Chairperson, the outstanding program for me has two critical points that you mentioned. The provincial plans and arrangements, the second. The second one is the regulatory and institutional reform. If you master those, if you master them, you create it in the right way. Because why I'm saying that? Because, but also on your provincial implementation plan, it said should be concluded by end of February. In that meeting, by end of November 2015, in that February meeting, Chairperson would like also to get a report on the progress in that. And the second point in that slide, appointment of a provincial implementation agency, where are the timelines? we need to put a timeline today. Because God is not on our part. On the request, you know, if you matter those three bullets under commission work, it should be great for us. You streamline the system of participation of cooperatives, you lessen complex methods of land surveying, and you give an alternative form of the section of tenure. That should be brilliant. All our problems are in people. And to be able to offer it smoothly, I support it fully, and it must be implemented as soon as possible. I thank you, Chair. But then quarterly chairperson, okay, when they come back for quarterly reports that we're discussing in terms of what we're discussing prior was the transformation, and then they must come back with all other reports of the crisis details. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You've thanked me time. Thank you very much, Honorable Member, for the special and thank you from the colleague. Obviously, one of the outstanding things there and clearly defined is the fact that we need this report on a quarterly basis so that we can track things. But one of the things that maybe as you respond, you need to clarify as well, this is a bit of worry to me, is the fact that as we deal with backlogs, because the main issue here is backlogs, but ourselves as well, we are still creating backlogs. Because if you look at 2014-15 target, you yourselves are saying we've delivered 140,000 houses and only 71,000 are registered. So in other words, we still have not mastered the art of making sure that we do not create backlogs as we move forward. So as we are trying to clear the backlog, but we are still edging on the backlog. So for me, that is very key. That's critical. As you respond, for me, deal with that. Why is it still difficult for us to register all the houses that we built in that particular financial year? What is the challenge? Thank you very much.
Thanks. Thanks, Chair. I'll just go ahead and turn in the Chair. I think the important thing is that what we need to be clear, just on the backlog, our figures have been tested against the housing subsidy system because that's the system that we use against the deeds office, so there's a marrying of information between title deeds, the IDs, so that's how this information, and we've done an intensive process. And I think what we're asking is that this is an intensive process that we've taken with the EAAB, so that backlog, unfortunately, it might sound like it's unbelievable, but I think what we need to be able to do is recognize some period of success. So if we're saying that it sounds too small, then I think what we need to be clear is that this represents, and we haven't been disputed because it's independent. COVID we've done analysis and even with the basis. So I think what we need to also indicate, so that's the backlog, and Anton's got the details, and we've opened that up. So the department, as government, we've opened that up and said, yes, that's the first thing. The second issue is that I think the acting PG met with the DD for Rural Development and Land Reform under who the Chief Surveyor General and the Chief D's office rest. And they said, because there's a whole range of perceptions that there's a huge backlog at the DD office. And DD's Shabane took the liberty of calling three or four meetings with us together with the acting DD and said, guys, come and sit down with us and tell us where the backlog is. And you know what? We couldn't say where it was because there was no backlogs. There might be a backlog of a couple of thousand or whatever, but it's not in millions or hundreds of thousands. I think, Anton, there's a backlog in the Free State and parts of KZN where there's some blockages. But I think what we need to be able to understand is that there's not a huge backlog, and the problem lies not with the chief registry. It doesn't lie with the chief surveyor general. It lies with us. We must take responsibility for that. And I think we must be honest with everyone around that fact that that's where the problem is. Let's not blame someone whether it's good or not. And I think we must admit where government works and the lead office works quite well in relation to turnaround. I mean, if anyone in this room bought a house in the last couple of months, you know that it's not this huge backlog that exists. Those things are happening. So yes, there are backlogs, but those backlogs sometimes are with us. So the attorneys we appoint, the planners we appoint, in terms of the entire process, from proclamation of the land, from township establishment to registration. Yes, I think Member Mingles is correct. Housing has had a very successful process in relation to registration of townships. So people might not have, the title might be registered, but it might not be in their possession. And I think that's the one issue that we need to understand. So it might be in Mokhale City, you know, people haven't collected, they might be. And we've said that those are issues that we will go back and look at. Well, the titles are registered, but where are they? You know, that is a big issue. So if you look at, that's an issue that, so I think we must separate it. The third issue is that in relation to what we, and I said, you know, we can say what the reasons are. One of the things that we did was we paid P5, the P5 milestone before the P4. You remember this. That the P5 chair is where we pay for the house, the construction. And P4 is for the registration. Now, because it was a small amount at various periods in relation to what the total subsidy is, your developer does the entire chain. And they walk away from this. So in many instances, they didn't even register, they didn't even lodge, because they got paid for the house. And that's an issue which a lot of provinces, and we need to be honest, it was never Minister or any of our colleagues at national that approved this. It was particularly provincial. So the acting DG, when he was the Western Cape HOD, never allowed those kinds of things to occur. So you'll see some of those backlogs are not as high as provinces where those things occurred. But you're now coming back to reap the negative reward. And so it's not trickery. We're saying to you, we have to fund this. Some of that money was paid. And that's another issue that we will have to go and look at in terms of, we said to the provinces, hold those people accountable. Be they a planner, be they an engineer, be they a. And yes, the cost of that 1.3 is a loss of housing opportunities. I mean, we've been honest with the committee and chair with yourself. It's coming out of the HSDG, and if we did our work properly, we wouldn't have had to pay it. Same for some of those things that were outside of our. So yes, it does often, it does have a negative impact in terms of delivery. But we said to provinces, this is a political commitment we made. We've got to make good on it. So you go, you reprioritize it, but it's not going to impact. So what we need to indicate to the portfolio committee, and we'll indicate to the minister, the fact that we're asking for this money to be funded out of the HSEG and ring fence does not in any way justify any down revision of any of your amounts of money in terms of what you want to be able to allow for that. I think the issue is that in relation to who did this work was always and still is outsourced. It's never done internally. Houghton, Member Munezi, you'll remember, had a section that did some of the old townships, the establishment. Western Cape as well, they had internal people that did it, but over the years that capacity has been depleted, people have retired and we haven't replaced. But we've gotten used to not appointing attorneys and conveyancers because it's a lot more lucrative outside. So that's the last point is that I think what we must be, you know, it's the slide that we've indicated. Our system of title registration is very complicated. It's expensive. It's very meticulous. And we mustn't take for granted the fact that it's that's been an issue that has created some of these bottlenecks and but I think what you've indicated is we pay people, they do the work, we hold them accountable. The issue is that we made this commitment and as officials and bureaucrats we hand to you, we want to make good on this. But there's some stuff that we need to be able to do. Just the other issue is, Jay, in 1994, we inherited a situation where there was a lot of areas where township was not established. Jay, I'll give you a very good example which will resonate with yourself. The civic center, for example, in Matema, Memo-Memezi, that portion of land is still agricultural. It's still under agriculture, and I know that Kuruleni Metro has been having huge problems. I think there's areas in KZN. So we're having to have to go back, redo diagrams, redo the engineering services, and it's a meticulous and it's a time-consuming process. Some of it's taken between 8 and 10 years to do some of those things. But it's not been an excuse to say that, well, that's the, for example, Transnet transfers, those kind of things have. So process is, those are some of the realities that we have to be able to deal with as a bureaucracy and administration of this process. But what we have been honest about is, yes, at 1.3 billion is coming out to the HSDG, it could have built obviously about 9,000 more houses and 11,000 houses. Or units. Secondly, some of that efficiencies were created as a result of our inabilities and inefficiencies. Whether we want to go and blame whoever now is there. What we need to be fair to the deeds office and rural government and land reform is they played their part. I mean, Didi Shaban indicated and given the commitment. If there's a backlog, you come back to me and I will sort it out. Thanks.
There were specific questions that we can deal with. I think there was a recommendation to come up with a breakdown on the backlog by province and by city. That's doable. In fact, we know now the backlog for Nelson Mandela Bay Metro and then to Anton and the Dean. We can tell you exactly by city, by province. So we will be able to bring that information to you. Never discovered the question about the HSDG, how much of the HSDG units that were forfeiting by focusing on cattle deeds with 1.4 billion rands, I think is unsatisfactory. There was a question about the existing capacity. Remember, this is a specialized field. It's conveyancing, it's town planning, you need town planners, and you need conveyances, which is a specialized field. And it's difficult for provincial departments to retain some of this expertise or resources. So they end up using the buying power to fix the rate of doing this kind of work. Because if you don't have expertise in-house, then you go out to the market, and the Public Finance Management Act expects us to start first from within. And if that capacity is not in existence, then you go out to the market. If you look at the areas where we have done well in terms of title deeds, you notice that it's areas where you have big 10 key developers. If you look at it, for instance, on the entry gateway, we're doing well in terms of issuance of title deeds. We can give you a breakdown figure. In fact, we're sitting at close to 80% in terms of issuing title deeds on the entry gateway, precisely because you have a 10 key service provider who's been working there for a very long time. He's not going to go away. So he needs the 2,000 rand amount of money, or at least 1,000 amount of money that you are keeping or withholding, because we withhold a certain portion of that grant so that the contractor must not go away with the money. That's the people. That's the people that Nevin is talking about. So it's working well where you have big contracts, big projects, and big developers sitting for a very long time there, like entry gateways. So we're doing well. But in other projects, small contractors, they do trade-offs. And do I go back and forth on this issue? It's costing me more than what the department is withholding. They simply walk away. That was the case in the past. But we're trying to find means and ways to get them to deal with this particular item. So if you go for big contracts in big projects, it works wonders. Then the question about the 3.7, remember we're not only delivering BNG RTP houses, we deliver social houses, rental housing, rural housing in Limpopo, the part of some of the projects, rural housing where you issue a PDO, permission to occupy in some cases. So if you do a reconciliation of that figure, it's because we have done badly. Because you will say less rental housing, you will say less CRU, you will say less affordable housing, places like Cosmo City, because there you're dealing with first class conveyancing. So in most of those mixed development types of projects, you have given out facilities for affordable housing or care housing. So the figure of 700, if you do a reconciliation, is not necessarily off the mark. If you take out all the other areas like affordable housing, hostel development, rural housing, social housing, because you don't need title deeds for those individual units. So it's not necessarily a bad figure at all. But we can have that breakdown. We should ask the team to do a reconciliation of all of those numbers so that we get to know how many social housing units, how many rural housing developments that we've done in areas that are under the jurisdiction of Amakhosi, for instance. You're not going to issue a title deed there. So those are some of the things that factor in the 3.7 figure that the President has talked about. I don't want us to start doubting our own figure. then the question about the not mastering the art of conveying, Chair, it is a relevant question because the backlog is growing. You saw it last year. We delivered 140,000 housing opportunities, and we did 70,000. So there is still a challenge in various areas, but we are able to break it down by province as well, and we have managed to arrest that particular challenge by province and by city. The February deadline, I think we can achieve that. It is doable. I wanted to share here that with you that there is a study that we commissioned with Urban Landmark and FIMAC, which came up with the conclusion that our conveyancing arrangement is first class, the first world conveyancing arrangement, but it's helping to deal with some of the challenges that were faced within the RTP BNG space. So they went further to recommend that maybe we would need a conveyancing arrangement or some kind of a deed office in each and every municipality or in each and every district municipality so that we make it more accessible. And for instance, those people who want to transact themselves, those who have been owning the RTP houses for more than 8 years, mm-hmm. and now they want to sell their houses because they are allowed by law to sell. Mm-hmm. And it takes time for them and it's costly for them to go to the nearest deed office or to deal with some of these issues. So there was a view by Urban Landmark that probably the approach, the conveyancing and the transferring arrangement, all the work that the deed office people are doing, is not easily accessible to this market. Maybe we need to find a means and way to make it more accessible. Chair, we can provide a breakdown by how we're doing in terms of pre-1994. I think there was a slide that talked to that. How we're doing in terms of post-1994. Going forward, we'll be able to report accordingly. Most of the questions are recommendations, and I think we can achieve the February deadline.
Thank you very much. That takes us to the end of the second report. We're going to the third and the final report, which will be presented by the National Home Builders Registration Council to talk to us about their transformation program. Transformation! Yes. Today we are talking transformation. You can just have 5 minutes body break, yeah. but we are going out because immediately already we are starting. So at least at 1 we are done. I don't know if you looked at the program of the house today. We are breaking at 8:30 tonight. for bees to prepare. The house is continuing at 2, and we are finishing later at 8:30. And you know, that could be 9. So I just wanted to go and have a proper lunch from 1 to 2.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chair and members. I was just saying to my colleague, finally a woman presents. So,
yay!
Transformation. Then my phone. So what I'm going to present what I'm going to present to the members is actually a draft strategy of sort of transformation in NHPR system. And so maybe just give a quick background. We've been doing a lot of work in relation to transformation at NHPRC, at least for the last 3 years that I have been there. And it is for the first time that we'll put things into context in terms of, within the context of social transformation. So what I'm presenting is a draft and the agreement with the executive, the chair of the Social Transformation Committee was for me to present the draft so that I get as much input that I can, so that when we come back to present the final document, it has all the input from the important stakeholders. Share the content of my presentation. The background with you, Chair. The premise of our presentation is obviously within the context of outcome 8 of delivering sustainable human settlements and with NHDRC ensuring compliance to national norms, standards, and quality within the whole building industry. And Chair, we also within that context, we undertake to ensure improvement of participation of levels of previously disadvantaged groups in the human settlement sector. And we term our social transformation and empowerment program as STEP in this process. In terms of the beneficiaries, again, youth is women, people with disabilities, and military veterans. And in terms of the programs that were presented on, or some of which have been unfolding for the past 2 years, entrepreneurial development, provincial procurement, sector skills development, and human capital development both internally and externally. And internally, Chair, is just recruitment processes internal to NHPRC, and externally the bursaries that we offer to students who are studying the skills that we require at NHPRC, for example, students who are studying to become engineers, quantity surveyors, etc. So we're making a concerted effort to ensure that those students represent people from disadvantaged groups. In terms of positioning, I've mentioned that we've done, we've been doing a lot of work, we just haven't put it into context yet, and we have had a successful women empowerment program where we've put through 100 women in partnership with GIPS through training, academic training, mentorship and coaching, technical training by NHPRC, and we're now going to be, we've profiled them on CityFest, I'm sure our members would have seen the different profiles. And the last phase is to now take these women through or with the leadership of the minister and profile them to the different provinces. And here we are very clear that we would like the 30% set aside of procurement in relation to housing to go to these women, to the 100 women that we have trained. Because if we don't do that, we are not going to know the impact of the training that the NHPRC has provided. We also have been doing a lot of work in terms of the brigade program. We've been working with, or we are currently working with different municipalities where they identify youth who want to operate within the construction industry, specifically home building, and NHPRC offers training to these students. We also link them to contractors who then mentor them further. So that's the work that we're currently doing. We've put through about 1,300 students together with different municipalities in different provinces, and that work is continuing. Some are being absorbed within the labor component of construction, some are still undergoing training. We also provide our normal dozer training, share where we identify through the technical assessments that are undertaken by bulldozers, we identify weaknesses in relation to the capability of the different home builders, and we provide training in that regard. So the training is targeted to the weaknesses which we identify. Now, where are we going as an institution in relation to social transformation? So we would like to be specific and target and have targeted recruitment, as I mentioned earlier, also in terms of human capital development and the positives that I spoke about earlier on. We also would like to ensure and the specific procurement opportunities in the organization in terms of ensuring that those opportunities go to previously disadvantaged groups. So quickly, in terms of the targets that we've put in relation to the strategy itself, as I mentioned earlier, on 30% of opportunities we believe should go to women-owned businesses or entities, 10% to the youth, 10% to the military veterans, or to the empowerment of the military veterans, and 5% to the empowerment of people with disabilities. So we've been working with a number of stakeholders. For example, when we were rolling or implementing the Women Empowerment Program, we worked with PIDD, the National Department of Public Works, with the Master Builders South Africa, with the Property Charter. So what we're saying is that we want to continue to have those relationships and extend them to other departments. We are currently talking to the Department of Public Works, again, exposing the women that we've trained to construction-related opportunities. We will be meeting the Department of Women to take the next step. We also would like to be, we are having discussions with the Bankization of South Africa to ensure that they also support the cost of social transformation through our advisory committee that looks at external relationships. Just a quick one in terms of our strategy map. What underlies our strategy are the different programs that I've mentioned. Supply chain, for example, within the context of an HDRC in relation to procurement opportunities. The Center for Research and Human and Housing Innovation, which looks at training for the youth and designated groups. Our technical division, where you are our engineers, our country surveyors reside, to ensure that just that representation in that regard, our project management, human capital, education, training and development in our special project unit. And the second step from the bottom is what would define our success at an institution. The promotion of women, of youth, people with disabilities and military veterans in terms of empowerment. Developing policies to ensure that we are able to roll out social transformation in HDRC beyond the work that we have done. Aligning institutional arrangements to the STEP, which is the Social Transformation and Empowerment Program. Ensuring that we monitor the implementation of the system or the strategy itself. And continuing to effectively manage the STEP budget. Now, in terms of alignment, I've mentioned the different targets which we're putting in place or which we are proposing. And in terms of the elements, again, it's women empowerment, youth empowerment, military veterans empowerment, and empowerment of people with disabilities. And our mission continues to be protecting housing consumers and improving the capabilities of our home builders within this context. And eventually, we believe that step will ensure that the delivery of sustainable quality homes by the designated groups. Chair, in conclusion, in terms of how we intend to monitor and evaluate, obviously the executive committee of the NHBRC will, on a monthly basis, monitor the implementation of social transformation in NHBRC. I have mentioned the Social Transformation Committee of Council, which has requested that we report on a quarterly basis, and obviously our normal reporting processes and stakeholders, which is the NINMEC and Portfolio Committee, and in terms of quarterly reports, and again the annual reports, again to NINMEC and Portfolio Committee. So thank you very much. This is what I wanted to share with the committee. I will take you.
Thank you very much. You can see who I am.
That's the presentation. One of the important things about this presentation is that it's a draft. You still are allowed to make even written submissions if you can. You don't have to limit yourself to what you want to say here and now. You can still submit any other written submission. Florence, your question? If you don't have any, you don't have to ask.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Now, I agree with you that, you know, these are fruits of transformation. So this is good presentation. It's really transforming our society. You know, we want our youth to begin to build our own houses and live through these means. Just to check in all these areas, no, training on entrepreneurial development, financial procurement, all the various other critical skills of the sector. Are you also checking that they can somebody now can move and even link with a TVET or university from your training? Are you trying to ensure that whatever training can take somebody somewhere? But generally, this is a good project. I think the department, human development is really doing well. This thing of developing people, while developing a country, we must develop people who think they are nobody, they must become somebody. We support it. It must move and take as much as possible.
Thank you, Honorable Minister. This time we are not doing it.
Thank you, and thanks for the presentation. good sense, man. I want to share, you know, I think the idea or the goal that we're going to around this 5% of the target group, so it's 8-10-10-5. One thing that one would like to see more is, obviously, you are not going to achieve this, you know, in the medium term. This is a long-term view, to be able to see how you see yourself getting to it. Because when you say 55% can come next year, the order where you will not say 2%, which means you have 3% out. You know? But then if you give kind of like a crab that tries, you know, you are going towards a particular goal. And what one would like to check, whether I'm talking about the entire procurement budget of NAPRC and how much is it sitting at now. Because you kind of imagine, because when we say 10%, 10% of what? If it's 10% of 100,000, it's not much. You know? But then when we deal with numbers, they can be confusing. So because content is clear, 10% is meaningless, but then if you know how much we deal with, it has what the current state is. Surely there are some, there already, even though there's no strategy like this in place, there are qualities at an informal level where the enterprises that you do business with, they fall into the categories. So I would like to find out, yeah, where are we now with regard to this? And whether this only extends to only procurement, or it also gets into the operational base. I think once those questions are answered, then, because the content is important, one thing that's lacking here is the current context of this particular program. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Kaka. I knew that if they were not expecting this to fight, because I saw the word in the current
term. Thank you, then, for begging me on the track. But I hope it's not really easy. Okay. First of all, I think it's interesting and encouraging to see the bigger 10%. Because you know that there are big things that you know that the 10% mean a lot to those military veterans. But I'd also be interested to find out if in some cases or instances where military veterans themselves are not involved, but in other cases they are dependent, who become interested in this business or being involved. What can be done there in that situation? And now the last one is the challenges that we face in the transformation process. What makes me ask this question is that what I know is that when it is real transformation, you will hear people whinging, feeling the pain, unhappy, complaining. If it's smooth, I know it's not. So what are the actual challenges and things that are supposed to be on your way being obstacles in this process of transformation? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Papa. Honorable Papa.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just to say a good presentation. Also, when we refine the document, then we'll be able to move forward. But Chairperson, on the strategic positioning and president's training, I want to find out where you will be training those builders. Where are these builders training centers? Do you see one in some places? At that time, I spoke to the CEO that time, I'm going to repeat the chair, that they were building training centers that were created, constructed and created by the Department of Labor. Some few years they were closed down. And for me, I think it's important to go back and the Department of Labor, to partner with the Department of Labor and revive those training centers, building training centers. Because really they were useful. They're not taking away the work, the responsibility of basic training, further education and training in terms of the TVET colleges. But I think they are enhancing the program, because those ones would be the shorter program. That would assist all municipalities to send, first and foremost, also their building inspectors within the human services, to keep on getting training and get developed and empowered by and then the NHPRC will be able to run those well, maybe partnership in terms of, I'm not sure, but the NHPRC will be able to run those calling training centers. That would be my focus. Thank you, Chairperson. Otherwise, please finalize and then we'll talk. Thanks, sir.
Thank you very much, Honourable Member. I think overall it's a good presentation, but obviously the case of the student is in the kitchen, because remember, still in the early stages, so we still need to see as the implementation goes on if we will be able to do. But one of the things that I, around the youth brigade program in particular. To date, it's about 1,300 youth that you have trained. You've got 6 regional districts, isn't it? And I think one of the things that maybe the strategy must do is to try and give targets to regional districts around that program, so that you can be able to increase the number. Let the regional offices compete in terms of how much the youth that they can train.
Yeah.
And make sure that in this process we have more to it, right? I think for me that would be, but at the end of the day, this doesn't only rest with the head office. Even those, I don't know how the structure works, I'm just saying it would be nice so that this training goes down to everybody. But generally we are heavy, there would be other areas that we would need to look at. In terms of the, I think that question that is asked by Honourable Ghana is important in terms of 30% of what? Because we can get out of here very excited, and if we are talking about 100 grand, you know what I mean? So it's going to be very important that if we talk empowerment, in real terms, it's going to be very critical.
Thanks very much, Chair, and thanks to the members for the valuable input. And just to respond to a few issues, the first one being the training of the youth beyond what we are currently doing. I mentioned when I was presenting that we are also looking at offering bursaries for now your academic or your academic studies through your tertiary institutions. So what we plan on doing is, when I said we have then linked each youth to a contractor who has established to sort of mentor them,
The intention is that the input that we get or the feedback that we get from the contractor, we then utilize to say which youth can we take further, who shows interest and is keen to operate in this industry. Because at the same time, you want to avoid fly-by-nights. Who is keen, and then those are the youth that we target to put through training further in terms of tertiary institutions, in engineering, in quantity surveying, geotechnical science, etc. Because we still struggle as a country, particularly with regard to geotechnical science, still, we struggle as NHBRC. So that's what we're looking at. So we also intend, when we come back to present the final strategy, we'll present an action plan too. It links to the strategy, which then explains how it shows size per province in terms of how long we're going to take to achieve certain things, etc., so that you are able to hold us accountable. So in terms of how we get there, in terms of numbers, I was just thinking at the top of my head that the annual budget of the NHBRC is about 800 to 850 million, and about 60% or 63% goes to operational expenditure. Now, at this point, I can't quantify how much of the operational expenditure will actually go towards procurement, but just to give members a picture, we're talking about a budget of 800 million, 63% of which is operational expenditure. So it's, when we look at structuring, we'll look at that in terms of those percentages. And the dependence of military divisions, I think it's good input, Chair. It's something that we will take further to look at how we then bring those dependents into the bigger scheme of things. When we give a report in terms of the action plan, we will outline clearly what it is that we will have explored. Training, Chair, I've mentioned we've got training coordinators in each province. And training happens in each province. But again, I think it's an issue of just solidifying those targets and ensuring that we hold provincial managers accountable. Otherwise, thank you very much for the input.
Thank you very much. That was the last input in the discussion. That means we've come to the end of the meeting. I just wanted to inform colleagues, particularly honorable members, but that will also impact on the department moving forward for the next portfolio committee meeting. The House from next week is sitting at 11 on Tuesday. It will be sitting from there. And that affects us as this portfolio committee, which means, therefore, between ourselves, we will have to prioritize things that must be discussed. But also that means we're going back to nine permanently for the whole of November into the year, because that will give us only 2 hours for the portfolio meeting. So the meeting will be sitting strictly at nine till around about quarter to 11, right? The members then go to the outset. So that's one day. As to know that from next week, unfortunately, the House of Justice will be convening at 11, and that affects them. Thank you very much, colleagues, and thank you very much. What do you want?
You know, there's lots happening in student politics. You know, sometimes you're in the meeting, but the point of before is a crucial one. That's the most important one. Chair, something that you need to note. I was not even aware. I got an email from a community member, someone, I don't even know where it came from, regarding some regulations that CISOS has published. CISOS has published regulations, and I understand that the comment period is coming to an end next week. And it was just all the data, I think almost all the data they were presenting on 2 days up before they presented, they issued this regulation and they were not even, when they came to the community, it was not even right about the thing. And I think as a committee, we do need to be appraised of those regulations, because questions are going to come to us as public representatives, and there hasn't been, it's like that against us. So if we can just get onto that, those regulations, then I think there are 3 of them that were gathered in.
No, we will.
It will help. Thank you.
No, Chair, but it was raised when they were here. The only thing is that we did not make a follow-up, but it was raised. I remember particularly the Chair of the Board, Mr. Meyer, he said we are being delayed by not. So it was raised. Just that it's important what Madalagana is saying in terms of looking at those, but it was. We will make that follow up and we noted. Then the next thing is daily agenda. Rather than less, I really am actually in this meeting. Thank you very much.